call this meeting to order. Thank God. Thank God. Let me all go. Thank you all for coming. It's kind of 3 o'clock, so we're going to kick this panel off. Yes. If it's going not very well, come in earlier. Okay. So thank you all very much for coming along for this 3 o'clock panel. The title of which is... Well, I don't know that.
Steampunk.
I think we'll dispense with the official title. I'm going to rename this panel, Oh My God, It's the Godfathers of Steampunk Here, together in England, for the first time ever. Thank you very much. I mean,
That's good. I like that.
It's kind of like, you know, the Beatles reunion or something.
Only alive.
So we have, as I say, we have with us the This Is Where It All Began. You could also call this panel Steampunk It's All Your Fault, which is but we'll avoid that. So on my left, Mr. K.W. Jeter, coiner of the term, which we shall cover, author of Infernal Devices and Warlock Knight and latterly Fiendish Schemes.
Yes, new book.
On my far right, Mr. James P. Blaylock, author of Homunculus, of Lord Kelvin's Machine, of The Aylesford Skull, and any number of the adventures of one Langdon St. Ives. And next to me here on my right also, Mr. Tim Powers, author of The Anubis Gates, and many other kind of associated steampunky kind of things, one might say. So we will talk for a little bit about how all this began and why, and then we're going to fight with the noise coming through from next door. But we will open up for questions, so think of some very cool questions to ask these very, very cool people. I'm going to open with you, KW. I mean, it seems like, obviously, it would be interesting to talk about the term, a story I know you've probably had to tell a million times.
Well, the real archivist of the term was actually my wife. I had written a letter to science fiction magazine, Locus Magazine, in the States many, many, many years ago. Unfortunately, too many years ago. In which I had said, I was making fun of the then current notion of everything being something punk, which really pretty much started with the cyberpunk coinage, which was probably William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, and that led to a whole bunch of other something punks happening. And just to take the Mickey out of it, I wrote this letter saying, well, there's, you know, three guys, myself, Jim, and Tim, and why not call us steampunk? And I thought that was where it pretty much ended. It's not exactly like, you know, putting it up on a billboard on the M-Way. And
if only you'd known.
If only I'd known. And you know, I did not know. I paid no attention to it. And every once in a while, my wife would mention something to me about it, saying, you know, that silly word you coined, you know, people are still using that. I said, yeah, you know, maybe some people are still using it. But at a certain point, I became aware that this crazy subgenre had actually sort of mushroomed up and was having a lot of fun and writing some absolutely great books, and that people were referring to it by the usage of this word I had coined. And she, like I said, she was the official archivist. Anytime somebody talked about where the word came from, she would have a little JPEG of the letter I wrote to Locus, and she would send it to them saying, no, this is it. This is the official explanation. This is the urtext of the word, and please correct your mistaken attribution. The only people who failed to correct their attribution was the New York Times. The New York Times did an article about how steampunk was taking over the world, and the reporter attributed the word to a good friend of ours, Paul DeFilippo. You know Paul, don't you?
Yeah,
wonderful guy, great writer. And they said, no, the word steampunk was coined by Paul DeFilippo because he used it for the title of his steampunk trilogy. And Paul very graciously was the one who contacted me and said, you know, please don't kill me. You know, it was the New York Times, not me. And I contacted the New York Times reporter and said, look, you know, here's my wife's JPEG, blah, 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 please correct this. And astonishingly, the New York Times did not regard this as a matter as important as, say, covering the Iraq war or, you
Much
know.
Of it would be.
Yeah. So for some reason, the correction got pushed off the front page, and I don't think ever really happened, which just goes to show where their priorities are at. That's how it kind of, you know, started rolling along. So I always take great pains to say, no, I did not invent steampunk without the quotation marks. I invented steampunk with the quotation marks, just the term, because I'm very sure all of these wonderful books and creative writers and people doing astonishing things in this crazy subgenre, I'm sure they would have been doing it under some other label if there hadn't been a label that got taken from me. I'm trying to actually avoid the blame for the bad books as well.
Welcome to the blame. Let's just talk then about steampunk without the label on either side, because in order to get to the point of having to label something, we should really identify what it was you were attempting to label. you guys in the, what we're talking about, kind of must be the late 70s, we're all at college together, or the mid to late 70s. Something must have been in the water there for you to think, you know, we should all start writing madcap Victorian adventures. So, Jim, maybe you can just give us some idea of the current, I mean, The Eight Box Affair is pretty much regarded as the first steampunk story in the modern, you know, forget Jules Verne, all those.
That's 78.
78, yeah, I think I wrote it in 77.
What led you to write a madcap Victorian adventure about the Eight Box?
I actually was binging on Robert Louis Stevenson heavily at the time, and was crazy for some of his wrong box stories. I was a big fan of The Suicide Club and a number of other stories and novels. And also, Tim suggested that I read P.G. Wodehouse, which I began to do fervently and became addicted to it. So I was kind of switching off, trying to read all of Stevenson and all of Wodehouse, which is, by the way, impossible. It was so much fun, I wanted to have that same kind of fun.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it, having that kind of fun.
I forgot about the Stevenson thing. I remember you recommended Stevenson's The Dynamiters to me. Remember The Dynamiters? It's about Mormon terrorists.
Yeah, it's wild.
Seriously, sinister Mormon terrorists blowing up the American Southwest. It's a fabulous book.
Heaps of eyes and pyramids. It's wonderful.
Yeah, great book. Okay.
So you're kind of wanting to play with the same toys that these guys are playing.
Yeah, exactly.
Tim, what are your memories of that time and the kind of things you were all discussing over beers?
Mainly seem to link it with a project Roger Elwood came up with. He was an editor who was real prominent in the 70s and kind of went away. But at one point he told us that there was a British publisher who wanted a series of novels about King Arthur reincarnated throughout history. So you'd have King Arthur sinking the Spanish Armada and chopping open Nazi tanks with Excalibur. And he asked Jeter and I and another writer if we'd be interested. And since we were young and naive, we said, sure. Realistically, luckily the project fell through, but if it had gone through, probably all the volumes would have been published under one house pseudonym, like Franklin W. Dixon. But after each of us had written, we divvied up history, you know, you can have this bit, I'm 100 years later.
Yeah.
And we had to leave time for Arthur to die and grow up again. But when the editor said, no, we hate the idea now, All of you take your books and get lost, and incidentally, you owe us back any money we fronted you. Each of us was left thinking, very shortly, editors are going to be baffled and sickened by all these books about King Arthur reincarnated, and I'm going to get mine in before you get yours in.
Sure.
But Jeter, luckily, had happened to draw the straw labeled Victorian England.
Yes.
And Jeter stumbled on...
You drew Siege of Vienna, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanted Siege of Malta, but somebody else had one too close for Arthur to grow up again.
Yeah.
Which frustrated me because I had a book on the Siege of Malta.
Yeah.
And they said, you can't do it. And I said, but I have a book. And Jeter said, take the Siege of Vienna. And I said, but I don't have a book about the Siege of Vienna. And he said there probably was one.
Yeah, yeah. See, this was pre-Google. So
it was,
you actually had to actually get a book to do research.
But what galvanized this is that Jeter found the ultimate research source for 19th century London.
Yes, there we go, yes.
And
people still ask me about that. What was that book that all of you guys started digging stuff out of? And of course, it was Henry Mayhew, a Victorian journalist and researcher who did a book, eventually compiled all of his pieces into a book called London Labor and the London Poor. And it's a really great book. And of course, all the statistics in it are completely worthless. The numbers are completely worthless, but we didn't care about the numbers. All we cared about were all these fabulous anecdotes about, you know, people making a living collecting dog feces on the sidewalks of Victorian London. And you think, wow, Jim wound up, you used that in Homunculus, didn't you?
I am ashamed to say I probably used it more than once.
Yeah, because it was just
still using it.
Just so good. Yeah, so whenever anybody, is thinking of Victorian dog feces, you know, James Blaylock's name just...
it never gets old.
It never gets old. It never gets
it's
old.
Always good for a laugh.
It's always good. But anyway, so Henry Mayhew, I mean, all these anecdotes and interviews he had about how very desperately poor people made their living in Victorian England, and they were just filled with all sorts of colorful details. And so it was like, yeah, one book. That's all you need is one book with enough detail in it, and you're off to the races.
I actually, because I read Mayhew after KW suggested it, I decided to...
I think you still have my copy, actually.
Sorry. I actually decided to send off a King Arthur, a portion, an outline of a King Arthur novel to Roger Elwood. And it was rejected, as were all of my attempts to sell novels in those days. The interesting thing about Roger Elwood's rejection is that he... said that he suspected I was trying to make fun of his project, which I was not, actually. It had to do with George III being poisoned with snuff, actually. Snuff.
There you go.
William Blake was a character.
I hope you haven't lost that manuscript.
You know what? I think the world's better off without it.
So we have the Elwood project falls through. You have more knights from this.
Yes, I salvaged my book,
okay.
And was able to sell it to Donald Wolheim at Daw, and he put a cover on it with a three-legged horse, which everybody pointed out. Tim greatly expanded his book, and that became...
And it was Gates.
Drawing of the Dark, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Is that sad or what?
One or the other.
I knew somebody wrote that.
However, Drawing of the Dark is not a steampunk novel.
No.
But if I'm right, my recollection of the story, as it were, is that you did have a novel called To Serve in Hell, or a partial novel, which is the one that was then
right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what led to the evolution of this book into the Anubis Gates?
Well, while the poor King Arthur project still appeared to be alive, I had written a book set in 1650, and I had begun one to be set in 1810 when we were told the project was off and we owed them their front money back. And so I suddenly saw that King Arthur in that 1650 book was pretty arbitrary. And so I broke both of them up and pushed them together into one pile and assembled a book out of all the fragments. And that was, yeah, it was Gates. And it did take place in London in the 19th century. It wasn't Victorian London, it was Regency, but close enough.
There you go. People in funny clothes.
Who's counting?
Yeah.
It originally, I had written it for Lester Del Rey. I had showed him an outline and he, you know, gave me some money and said, yes, go. And so I wrote the whole book and showed it to him, and he said, no, this is no good, I want my money back. And I said, it's gone.
Yeah.
Rent, beer. And he said, well, then you owe me another book, which he hated worse, and I gave him another book, and he hated that even worse. But luckily, and Blaylock was going through the same thing with Del Rey at the time. You know, why is your skill diminishing so dramatically? But luckily, we were selling the rejects to Ace Books by that time. And so it wasn't as depressing as it would have been if Del Rey had been the only editor out there.
Yeah. I mean, so the real takeaway, I think, of this chaotic account of the origins of steampunk, I mean, I've been interviewed where people have asked, well, you and Powers and Blaylock sitting around conspiring together, what was your master plan for creating this genre that would eventually, you know, take over the world?
Yeah, I know.
And we really should have gone with that and said, well, yes, we had a fortress of solitude where we would hang out, and we knew that this would all pay off, you know.
We knew we'd have to let it incubate about 30 years.
But it really indicates that we had nothing much more on our mind than a desperate desire to get anything published
from any
anywhere.
I was hoping for great wealth, and I sold the 8-box affair for 1/2 cent a word to Unearth magazine, so I made $40 on the
deal. Yeah, seriously. On a per word basis, I think you were way ahead of the rest of us. Yeah, you know, and it was this notion of, well, except for Jim, who was already happily married, I think for me and Tim, it was like this desire to, you know, maybe impress girls by getting something published or getting science fiction published, which was a vain delusion. We couldn't have been more, you know, deluded if we had been inhaling industrial solvents every day. Because it actually had the effect of turning their instinctive disdain for us into active loathing. I think there was at least one girl who slashed my tires when she found out that I had published a science fiction book.
I remember there was a girl back in 75 at a local Trader Joe's market, and I wanted to impress her, so I brought a copy of one of my books, and she said, oh, you wrote this, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I teach school. You could come talk to the students. I'll do that.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, you could explain to them how you wrote this book, and then when they grow up and read real books. And I thought, give me it back. I can cross out the inscription. Yeah. But I gotta say, I later gave one of those laser books to a young lady who worked in a jewelry store nearby, and
she didn't slash your tires. And, yeah.
She was impressed because the cover artist was the same cover artist who had done the Queen album News of the World, and we are married 33 years now.
There you go.
So yeah, see, those old laser books.
Yeah.
Let me ask
you. So that was the master plan at any rate.
Let me ask you, Jim and Tim, about William Ashbless. No steampunk discussion can take place without mentioning the venerable poet.
I was going to say.
Can you give us a little insight into the origins of Ashbless, and also tell us what happened when he suddenly appeared in two novel submissions simultaneously from different authors?
Okay, I'll tell the brief story. Tim and I were going to the same university, taking many of the same classes, and we thought that it was our duty to spend most of our time in the student union drinking coffee and eating ham and eggs instead of going to class. But we wanted to be doing something literary, and we had noticed that the school newspaper was publishing moderately bad poetry.
Moderate.
and they're not here. They might be. And Tim suggested that we could write worse poetry if we put our minds to it, which was an entertaining notion.
We did. We did.
And so Tim took out a piece
of paper.
It's
good to have ambition.
Tim wrote the first line of a poem, and he handed it to me, and I wrote a line, and we handed it back and forth until we had three quarters of a page or half a page or something like that. And that was the first William Ashbless poem. And I believe
we decided we needed a name for him.
Yeah.
And he should have one of those two-word names like Longfellow, Wordsworth.
Yeah.
So we each came up with a one-syllable word and pushed him. I'm glad we got him in the right order.
Yeah.
Bless Ash.
It would not have
flown.
No.
Wouldn't have flown.
Anyway, we ended up, I think, hustling five poems to the school newspaper, claiming that William Ashbless was unfortunately due to various grotesque, physical,
hideously deformed.
Yeah, it could not appear in public, and so Powers and I were delegated to make his name famous throughout the land. And they actually called on the telephone because we gave them my telephone number just so that if they wanted to see if there was actually a William Ashbless out there, they could call. And so the phone rang one night, and my wife Vicki picked it up, and they said, "Is William Ashbless there?" And she said, "Yeah, he is." And, you know, gave me a look and handed me the phone, and I told him a little bit about who I was, and I insisted that I wasn't going crazy, which seemed to impress him pretty well. I made it very, very adamant. I was very adamant that I was not going crazy.
Yeah, it helps when you insist on that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then we actually were at a Poetry Fullerton meeting. It was a society of poets who met on Friday nights. We went.
We were young.
We were very young, and they had beer and pizza most of the time, which, you know, was attractive. But we read some William Ashbless poetry, and which we found it amusing that people seemed to like it, and because it was full of literary allusions, we're pretty moderately sure it was good stuff. And I remember the woman who ran the Poetry Fullerton, Dr. Dorothea Kenny, who was a small Irish woman who gave me my first C on a paper. It turned out I couldn't fake her out, which, but we were reading this. I think Tim was reading an Ashbless poem, and she caught my eye and looked at me and said, "You should be ashamed of yourself."
Saw right through you.
Yeah. Anyway.
But when we needed poets in our books.
Oh, yeah. Tim was writing The Enormous Gates and put Ashbless in it. Actually, we decided that whenever we had a crazy bearded poet, it would be Ashbless.
And so we often did.
Yeah, and I was writing The Digging Leviathan at the time, and so I put Ashbless in my book. And then Tim sent his off to Beth Meacham at Ace, and I, several weeks later, sent mine off to Beth Meacham at Ace, and then she called on the phone and said, "You know, you've got a character very much like Powers' character with the same name." And I said, "Well, we'll change that. You know, call mine, you know, Benny Hill or something." I didn't come up with Benny Hill, but
that was
something like that.
Yeah.
And she said, no. She said, "I think there's evidence in the books that he's the same guy, unstuck in time." And I said, yeah.
Practically writes itself.
Yeah. More of the master plan.
But go ahead and, you know, recount the rest of the...
Well, so, she said, "No, you and Powers get together and sync this up." And so we figured, okay, Ashbless is evidently 150 years old or so in Blaylock's book, but that's a small speed bump to get over. And ever since, I know I've always put Ashbless almost like Hitchcock doing a walk on in my books as a good luck twitch. I'll make it in different languages, Guillermo Ceniza Bendiga or something, so that I don't want readers to always go, "Hey, there's Ashbless."
There you go.
But it's interesting that for a while before the internet, people were often fooled into thinking that it must be a real poet, because they say, well, he's mentioned in Powers' book, and then this Blaylock guy over here mentions him, and they'd actually go try to look him up. Of course, nowadays, you look in Wikipedia and it says they made him up.
But he's still around. Corrupting your names and.
Or Wikipedia wants you to believe that they made him up.
Yeah, there we go.
That's right. Yeah.
Let me touch upon the very London aspect of the steampunk that you've all written. We know it was inspired by Mayhew, but when did you first come to London, KW?
It was after Morlock Knight, but before Infernal Devices, and just came over on holiday and just sort of, you know, see whether I'd gotten anything right at all, and I hadn't, nobody seemed to mind. But there was back then, and this would have been in the late 70s, there was a store in Covent Garden, a shop in Covent Garden that specialized in old Victorian scientific and, beautiful brass and mahogany scientific instruments.
Wow.
And yeah, they were absolutely lovely, and I remember standing in front of the shop window, just mesmerized by these beautiful telescopes and orreries and all kinds of devices that probably nobody could figure out what they were for anymore. And that really was kind of the seed of Infernal Devices, the notion of somebody having a shop of unexplainable devices that he had somehow come into possession of. And so I don't think that shop is there anymore. It's probably been replaced by a Starbucks. It was a beautiful, beautiful shop window. And like I said, it was all this lovingly polished brass and mahogany, and just absolutely gorgeous. And of course, I couldn't afford any of that stuff, which is just as well. But I remember looking at that and thinking, oh, a shop of unexplainable technology,
yes.
Which I'm sure wasn't the name of the store, it was really something else. But that was kind of the seed of the notion of the shopkeeper, George Dower, having scientific and weird devices that he had no way in hell of telling what they actually did.
Well, what about you guys? What were your impressions on first encountering this city where you'd set so much of your work?
I think you'd been there before you wrote, didn't you?
Yeah, I think we were here in 1976, I think, and I had written stories by then, but I hadn't actually published. And I came looking for Charles Dickens, basically, because I was a majorly Dickens addict. And there was still a certain amount of Dickens to be found in London in 1976. We came home with piles of trinkets that we bought for 50p in antique stores and that sort of thing. The second time I came was in 2001, and a certain amount of that had disappeared, unfortunately. And I suppose it's many good things disappearing out of the world, you know.
Tim, you only came a few years ago. I was always astonished, having read the Nimbus Gates, that you had never visited London. It was always so much part of the fabric of that novel for me.
Well, I always like to postpone actually getting to work by doing research. You know, somebody can say, what did you do all day, Powers? I have a job. And I'd say, well, that's all very well, but I read a bunch of books and underlined stuff. And the more I do that, the more I can postpone actually writing. And so I remember I had a biography of John Keats with a beautiful street map of London as the end papers. And I photocopied that and then used Mayhew and different colored pencils to fill in the streets, like this is the rookeries, the bad areas, here's the, you know, aristocratic neighborhoods, and draw little lines to page numbers from Mayhew, so I can, if they're in this street, it's a Mayhew page, what have you. It wound up consistent. It wound up being, you know, a consistently described London, But I don't know what relationship it had to the actual London of 1810. I mean, the street names were the same. The river had the same name. But it probably not only derived as much from Robert Louis Stevenson and Arthur Conan Doyle, but also Fritz Leiber's Lankmar. What the hell?
So when you actually got to visit the city, did any of it tally in your own mind when you could physically see the places you've been writing about?
In person, it was all bigger. I think I pictured everything about 3/4 of its actual scale.
We're after 6:30. I'm going to just quickly throw open. Does anyone have any questions for our panelists?
Talk really loud.
Talk really loud. If not, I have more questions. Sir, let's go for you at the front. So I'm going to repeat questions in case you guys can't hear them. So the question is about any other authors who are one associates with this, the inspiration for this genre, yes.
Yeah, certainly Wells.
Yeah, I think I'd read most of Wells' science fiction novels by the time I was 12 years old. So I think I was doomed to write something that turned out to be steampunk just because of my early reading, the stuff I loved, you know.
Yeah.
And I think more recently, but still pre-us, Michael Moorcock's Warlord of the Air, Harry Harrison's Transatlantic Tunnel Hurrah. I mean, I was certainly aware of those, especially the Kelly Freeze cover on the issue of Analog with the Harry Harrison story in it.
Yeah. I had a considerable taste for Victorian Edwardian writers that at one time were pretty difficult to dig up. A big enthusiasm of mine was for George Gissing, who was a friend of H.G. Wells, and actually Wells wound up killing him. Not a lot of people know that. Yes, this is true. Gissing was a friend of Wells, and Gissing was very ill, living someplace in the south of France. And Gissing was a very fine novelist, which is how he and Wells became friends. And Gissing was running a terrible fever when Wells came to visit him, and Gissing's doctor said, "Whatever you do, don't feed him. That'll make the fever spike and kill him." And of course, H.G. Wells pretty much considered himself to be the smartest man in the world. He said, "Well, hell with that." And so actually fed Gissing on his bed a bowl of beef broth and killed him, you know. And a doctor comes into the room and says, "Who's been feeding this man?"
What did they tell you?
Yeah, and I always have this mental picture of Wells sort of pushing the bowl under the bed with his foot.
I don't know what happened.
But the thing is, I mean, we're aware of Victorian and Edwardian writers who are, you know, sort of well known in literary terms, but there were some really wonderfully trashy Victorian writers. My favorite, and probably a lot of people's favorites back then, was Harrison Ainsworth. Yeah, Harrison Ainsworth, probably best known for a novel called Rookwood, which has a famous account of Dick Turpin's ride from London to York in one night. And he was a fabulous writer. He was sort of like the Stephen King of Victorian literature. And really crazy, convoluted, wild prose, and just a fine writer. And he's a particular favorite of mine, Harrison Ainsworth. And I have to say, I've sort of appointed myself as a one-man anti-defamation league for Lord Bulwer Lytton. He is unfairly ridiculed. He was actually a fine writer, at least with his novels. His novels are quite good. His poetry is amazingly bad, and the best example of that is if you actually get the collected poetry of Bulwer Lytton, which is a huge book, he has an epic poem in it about King Arthur. It's Lord Bulwer Lytton's epic poem about King Arthur, and I guess I was reading it, and it's such a long poem, and I was starting to doze off. And all of a sudden, I was startled wide awake as I was reading this epic poem about King Arthur, saying, "Did Lord Bulwer Lytton just depict King Arthur killing a walrus in the Arctic Circle? And yes, he did. It's in there. It's either the worst poem ever written or the greatest poem ever written.
That sounds
wonderful to me. Yes, it does. It does. I mean, an epic poem about King Arthur, where King Arthur travels to the Arctic Circle and kills walruses, and they are demonic walruses with bloodstained tusks. It's just wonderful.
Which book is that?
Like I said, get the collected poetry of Lord Bulwer Lytton and read it from the beginning to end. And it'll take a while, but you'll find it. Yeah. It's not like this has an index where you can look up walruses. But anyway, Lord Bulwer Lytton, as a novel writer, was really a fine writer.
Let me ask what you guys make of steampunk as pop culture, because you started writing books. Something has transcended that. We're now in a place where there are steampunk conventions, there are people who flamboyantly wearing, you know, goggles with antennae and cogs attached. And what do you make of that? Why did you do that? Jim, explain yourself.
I'm very enthusiastic about all of steampunk culture that I've seen. I hear there's steampunk porn out there that I haven't investigated yet. I'm not quite sure about that. But costumers just knock me out, to tell you the truth. They put so much effort into doing what they do and end up looking so classy in these clothes that must have taken them months to sew up.
True.
That, I don't know, I think that they have so much labor into it that the movement such as it is should last another couple of decades before they wear the clothes out, yes. Which I'm happy for.
And I think what's interesting is that, you know, besides all the high sort of silliness, you know, which people are having a tremendous amount of fun with the costumes and building the props and everything like that, I think what's been a really gratifying development is that the actual literature of steampunk has sort of deepened and broadened in very interesting ways. And you know, there was a remark that Levik Tidhar made a while back, which I was absolutely thrilled by, because, you know, I've spent most of my life trying to piss people off, and he pissed off everybody at once by remarking that steampunk is fascism for nice people. You know, and I thought, you know, and I hadn't even met Levy then, and I thought, wow, I've got to meet this guy. To piss off that many people that quickly, that's great. And he was making a legitimate point. He was making a legitimate point that if we just look at steampunk as a literature that sort of has a nostalgic enthusiasm for a period that was actually very cruel in terms of how it treated both, you know, the working class and the poor in Britain, but also all around the world, the colonial nature of the British Empire. Then there's a problem, which, you know, we're just sort of skimming the surface in a sort of romantic way. But what's interesting is that I discovered by people, you know, who brought it to my attention, that steampunk has broadened and gotten deeper in a way where people of various ethnic backgrounds, whose grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents were subjects of the British Empire, you know, colonized subjects, are taking steampunk and using it as a hammer to break apart their own personal family backgrounds and write these really interesting stories, which essentially become Asian steampunk or African steampunk or Hispanic steampunk. And one example that I was completely blown away with is an African-American writer in the U.S. called, I hope I get this right, Balogun Ojatade, published a book called Moses, The Chronicles of Harriet Tubman. It's set in the American Civil War period, and which would naturally be, you know, the same time as Victorian England. And he casts the great real-life black slave liberator Harriet Tubman as his central character. Only it's a genuine, fantastic steampunk novel about her. And only Balogun calls it steampunk, which I thought was pretty cool. But that's a great example of people who are taking a subgenre that could easily be dismissed as, you know, just sort of, you know, nostalgia for a certain historical period, and really digging below that and getting into some very interesting facets of the world and what it was, and just taking this anarchic attitude towards the past and breaking it apart and really digging into it and analyzing and coming up with fabulous stories. And for me, that strikes me as really one of the most, the most gratifying development in the actual books and writing of steampunk.
It raises a very interesting point in that all three of you in recent years have revisited your steampunk world, if you like. The original books stem from the late 70s, roughly through to the mid 80s. But Jim, you've revisited Langdon St. Ives in novel form. Tim, you've written a sequel to Stress of Her Regard set in recognizably steampunk times, KW. We have been to Schemes recently. Just building on what KW's just said, going back to these worlds 20 years later, are you writing the same kind of books you were writing in those days? You're different people, you're different writers, you have lots of life experience. Are you saying different things in these books?
We're tireder.
We're tireder.
You know, I think my books, my most recent book, The Ale Sweet Skull, is certainly a different sort of thing than I wrote back in the 80s and very early 90s, only because I, as you say, I'm a very different person. You know, I have two sons who are 30 years old. My understanding of the world has changed quite a bit, I think.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so what, the tone of the book is different?
The tone is different.
The jokes are funnier?
No.
Less funny.
They are actually the same jokes.
Well, you know, I think this, I hope I'm right about this. I think maybe I'm a little bit better writer now. And I think that we all have access to a lot of research material. We can get at it much easier than we could before, and so we have to fake less. You know, there's nothing, if you need, I don't know, to know what Morecambe Bay looks like, all you have to do is look at Flickr and there are 10,000 photographs, and consequently, there isn't quite as much making things up, I suppose. So the whole, yeah, the tenor of the book is simply different than it used to be.
Tim, what about you?
Yeah, it's certainly true that research is a way easier thing now. Even using plain old paper books, you don't have to rely on the local used bookstore. There's ABE Books, which has every book known to man. I'm told there's a application for Google Earth that you can go street to street in Victorian London. God knows how.
They send a car out that takes pictures.
Yeah, real funny looking car. So certainly, the research is easier and way more thorough. And yeah, I like to think we're better writers now than we were in 1980. I don't know if you can tell when you start to lose it.
You just hope nobody points it
hasn't
out.
Hasn't happened yet. But certainly I would like to think I'm still writing the same sort of thing I was in those days, in that it would, I hope, have no social value at all. That it would be escapism and, as purely as I could make it, irrelevant.
Yeah, I've been a little concerned about, you know the sort of declining abilities issue also, to the point where I thought, you know, there are so many of these new young steampunk writers who are so infuriatingly good that obviously it's impractical to go out and kill them all. So we might have to institute the same thing they do, like say with pro golf, where you just have a seniors division for people like us. And if people say, you know, Jeter's characters aren't as convincing as younger writers' characters, but then again, he's playing in the seniors division, so we'll let him move the ball a little closer to the hole, and that'll suffice. And in that way, we could still keep on writing even as we become worse and worse.
Tim yesterday suggested that we get ahead of the curve by starting to write geriatric punk.
Geriatric punk. We were thinking it would be the next big thing.
Yeah.
You'd have like two people, a furious chase between two people pushing walkers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I'll get you. I don't think so. And if you were looking out a window watching this chase, you could go get a sandwich and come back, and they'd only have moved a few yards up.
Yeah, but I know, I think in terms of my own writing, especially in regards to the steampunk stuff, even given that I'm still essentially writing absurdist comedies with continuing the Infernal Devices and then Fiendish Schemes, because after all, any book like the new one in which somebody is in danger of being, you know, buggered by a mechanical orangutan, it's not
that
likely to be absurd as anything except, you know, comedy. Or to put it another way, I wouldn't like to meet the people who would think of it as anything other than a comedy. There is a sort of darker, tragic element that had started filtering into the writing. And some of that is that you reach a certain age and you have enough life experience that you can see that many of the things that you hope are going to turn out well didn't.
What are you saying?
Well, yeah, what can I say? It's one of those things where steampunk is interesting to me because I've gotten a little bit of a tentative handle on part of it, where essentially I can use steam as a metaphor for other technologies that transform the world, which initially we thought, oh yeah, this is going to be great. Oh man, I can't wait till we've got the internet up and running and blah, 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 blah. And it's going to be wonderful, push-button access to all the world's information. And we didn't anticipate that the NSA would have push-button access to our information. And so in some ways, like I said, there's kind of a darker and creepier element that came into my latest book, steampunk novel. And part of it is that, like I said, I've been able to sort of use steampunk as a prism to reflect not just on the Victorian period, but on our current period. And it says something, I think, about how I consider our current period, if I say that's essentially darker.
We are very nearly out of time. I'm going to throw open for one question. Whoever is quickest, it was you at the front, sir.
All the influences that steampunk has thrown out in cinema, television, games, what have you seen up there that you feel has been in steampunk to a level that you feel?
Okay, I'll just repeat the question. So all the various influences we've seen, steampunk has become more pop culture, I think. The question is, what have you guys seen that you perhaps didn't anticipate as the evolution of this genre that you created together? Jim?
What did we anticipate?
I'm not sure I anticipated anything. But there was a steampunk condominium offered for sale in Manhattan in New York. That shocked me.
Condominium. You know the difference. Okay.
Oh, how's that? Okay. It takes forever to put it
on. Seriously.
But, you know, there was a photo, and it was an exorbitant amount of money, and unfortunately, the interior was just about the ugliest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah,
so that was unfortunate.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm still anticipating the great, at least in terms of media, visual media, pop culture, steampunk thing. I haven't seen it yet. We're seeing little things sort of creeping into TV shows, and they say, oh, look, Detective or Mr. Castle, there's a guy dressed up like a steampunk there in the corner. And everybody goes, ooh, steampunk got mentioned on TV, isn't that great? or they just raid the costume department and stick a lot of clock gears on somebody and go, see, steampunk. But I'm hoping that some things come that I've heard rumors about will be the Blade Runner of steampunk, the translation into visual terms where we see it sort of all of a sudden, oh my God, that takes us up another level in terms of visual narrative. And I haven't seen it yet, and I'm hoping it comes along, but I haven't seen it yet.
I think the most astonishing consequence of it is that Jeter either is now or shortly will be in the Oxford English Dictionary. Obviously, they will include the word steampunk. Obviously, the derivation has to be him.
As long as they don't talk to that person from the New York Times.
They'll say it was Paul DiFilippo.
I'm very sad to say we are out of time. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, everybody.